This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the U.S. wants to invest $100 million on a new courthouse for Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the NAACP believes stealth racism is a huge obstacle for Black Americans. Joining us from our New York bureau is E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication. She's there along with John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy. And we've got Jeff Obafemi-Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome, everybody, and let's talk about this courthouse issue. Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is where terror suspects are held. The Defense Department tried to rush funding for this $100 million new courthouse through without allowing a House vote. But Congress said, let's wait a second. So there's already a courthouse near the intended location. U.S. citizens would foot the bill with tax dollars. And Senator Dianne Feinstein told CBS News there was another reason the project is being held up.
I asked them if they had looked at alternatives in the United States, looked at them, and the answer was no. I was surprised that they hadn't looked at Fort Leavenworth, at other places to build a courthouse to bring these people over, to keep them in secure custody, to try them.
Jeff, you already have a situation where, although we're not on the nicest terms with Cuba, we do have access to this little bit of real estate where we're keeping these prisoners. What do you think of the process of moving them to the United States?
Well, I think it would be a bit of a difficult process to do that. And also, you cut away the freedom of being able to do some of the things that you've been kind of vilified of doing and accused of doing down there, including torturing people, taking away their civil and human rights and that kind of thing. When you're talking about moving it actually into the country, you actually have a bigger responsibility. But I think that overall, to spend $100 million or to direct $100 million or even to attempt to in this time, it screams misdirected priorities. And I think that's evidenced by the bipartisan shock and awe at the mention of such governmental waste. You're talking about trying 60 defendants at $1.6 million per defendant, and building something that has 1,200 beds, dining facilities for 800 people, and a garage for 100 vehicles. And you sit and say, really, what is this all about? And considering the PR campaign that was recently launched by the Pentagon and some of the priorities that are coming out of there, I wonder if perhaps this was just an attempt to really build a $50 million courthouse and have people be in shock at the 100 and say, well, we can't spend that much, but maybe we can get 50.
John, there's a joke about Camp Fed, federal prisons being more like country clubs. I don't think anyone, certainly I wouldn't want to be in a federal prison, but this is, the proposal here is for a pretty nice facility. And is it, considering that there's only 60 suspects that are currently detained there that would be, you know, part of this new prison, is this overkill?
Well, I think that obviously, there's an awful lot of money being spent on what would seem to be a relatively small, although very important, target. And I suppose that's an old story. The government is very good at wasting money, and money in the background makes more money. I think that the main issue is the persistence of this whole Guantanamo situation at all, and this hint that we seem to get that the idea seems to be to keep it as far away from our actual continental soil as possible. You talk about trying to win people's hearts and minds. It's mysteriously unclear to this administration that the persistence and the slowness of that situation is going to leave the United States subject to all sorts of charges from all sorts of people for at least the next 50 years on the basis of the humiliation of these people. And so it seems to me that the idea of building a better jail or allowing a facility that can try more of them at one time is kind of a smokescreen for the tragedy of the issue itself.
ER, is the problem really here that we, as John is saying, want to keep the problem at arm's length, not the question of money?
Well, there is some truth to what John is saying, but I think that a case can be made for building a bigger, better, and more secure facility. Whether it should cost $100 million is the issue. You are talking about people for whom there would have to be gargantuan amounts of protection, security, whenever there is a trial, even of one of these people. Think about the trial of Saddam Hussein, for example. Think about how much is involved in that. So I can see that the Pentagon would think it needs something better, more modern, more convenient. And having facilities for sleeping 1,200, a dining hall for 800, I think they're taking into consideration all the people who will be coming to cover these trials. But the real issue here, beyond that, is the process by which the Pentagon tried to shove this through Congress without any opportunity for debate or any opportunity for a vote. They brought this up as an emergency action. And under that kind of proposal, in theory, Congress would have passed on it and there would have been no scrutiny at all. Luckily, somebody noticed what was going on, an oversight group, and said, pause. And members of Congress have said, we will pause. And probably at the beginning of next year, we'll actually look into this in greater detail.
It may be a tougher sell with the new Congress, but
that is true.
I want to return to an issue closer to home, still talking about incarceration. In Houston, the police department began using stun guns 2 years ago so officers could avoid shooting suspects with automatic weapons. Now, police are facing allegations of using high-voltage weapons, the tasers, indiscriminately against black suspects. So now the police department is under scrutiny. They've already had the reputation for using unjustified deadly force against Latino suspects. The taser, there was a recent taser incident in Los Angeles where campus police at UCLA brought a student to the ground when he couldn't show his ID. There seems to be the prospect that a non-lethal weapon would be better than using a potentially lethal weapon. But, ER, what do you make of this idea of tasers, race, and how often they're used in ways they ought to be used?
Well, it's really an intriguing dilemma. We don't want the police to be doing what we had in New York City recently, where the cops panicked and fired 50 bullets at three young black men, killing one, wounding two others. The Houston solution seemed to have been an attempt to get around that kind of thing by going to tasers. But it appears that the tasers are pretty much being used when the suspects are black. And sometimes the suspects haven't really done anything. In the case that brought this issue to light, a professional football player was tasered, if that is now a verb, for
tased, for having really done anything.
But he had the prominence to bring attention to this issue, and that's why Houston is now debating, and it's worth debating.
You know what worries me about this whole issue, though, is that we have to be vigilant. And yes, we do have to be vigilant about the issue of the intersection between race and police forces. But we also have to allow a very inconvenient thing about life as a human being on this earth interacting with others is that there will be screw-ups and accidents, and they will happen to black people. And the reason that I'm mentioning that is because in Houston, we have to remember that everybody here is human. You know, we can't be so pessimistic as to pretend that it's still Bull Connor and teenage protesters being fire-hosed on the street. The police officers in this case are people who go home. They have spouses that love them. They have dogs. They have beds. They have mortgages.
I hope they have cats.
And, well, actually, yeah, like we do. But if you talk to those officers in Houston, it has to be taken into account and thought of as equally as important as what happened to this individual who's making so much news because he's famous, which is that there were 700 assaults on the police over the past 2 years. That is 700 days in Houston. And also, over 30 officers in less than that time have been either fired or disciplined or re-educated based on the fact that accidents have happened. So there are definitely two sides to this one, and I'm not sure we have the evidence yet to say that black men and Latino men are being tased more just because of the color of their skin. It's more complicated than that in terms of who is doing what, when, and in what way, and what the appropriate response might be.
Want to jump in and tell everybody who we're talking to. This is, of course, News and Notes from NPR. I'm Farai Chidea, and we are speaking with John McWhorter, who we just heard, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow in Public Policy, E.R. Shipp, Professor in Journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle in Nashville, Tennessee. Jeff, how do you weigh in on the tasing, tasering whatever
taser
the language
rising.
Taser rising. Yeah. Help me out with that word and help me out with this subject.
I weigh in to say that I would not like to be on the other end of a bullet or a taser. This kind of issue has come up all over the place. It even came up here in Nashville several months ago, and members of the African American and the Latino community came together and had a study done. They wanted a study done on tasers. And what ends up happening in many cities is that you find that the largest percentage in Houston, I think there was 63% of the people that were tased or taserized or however we want to say were African Americans. Here, the largest percentage of them were also black, which really doesn't bother people who think, well, many of the criminals are black, which is more a mentality than a statistic. I think the issue is how do you preserve, how do you walk that line where you preserve the officer's life and his safety, but also the life and safety of the person who is a victim of this kind of attack? And how do you fairly make a choice in a situation where the stakes are extremely high and there is danger present? So I think that Fred Weary brought this to mind because he's a professional football player. And that big cat got out of that car, and obviously there was a little fear there. And because of his fame, now this is front and center. But I think they're also talking about the taser cameras, guns with taser cameras in them, so that you can see and hear what's going on at the time. And who knows, perhaps that will make the issue a little easier.
Want to connect this to the issue of what's being called stealth racism, because so much of this, including what we talked about earlier today in Long Beach, is about perception and how people are perceived when they are alleged to have committed a crime or have committed a crime, or sometimes when they're just walking down the street. The Reverend Nelson Rivers, chief operating officer of the NAACP, said white Americans have an absolute blind spot when it comes to admitting racism in society as an obstacle for African Americans. He was commenting on a poll done by Opinion Research Corporation this month. It showed that blacks and whites have different views on the impact that racism has in the modern day. And Reverend Rivers went on to say, racism requires accountability. No one wants to acknowledge they are racist or have benefited from a racial system. But Michael Massey, who's chairman of a black conservative group called Project 21, said many people have a raw, visceral contempt for whites, and they are much more vocal than what I hear or experience from whites. He's talking about African Americans there. How do you balance these statements by these two men? Is there such a thing as balancing them, or are we doomed to live in worlds where we have very different perceptions of what reality is? John?
Well, let's try this. White Americans do not want to admit that racism is a problem or that they've benefited from white privilege. Okay, let's say that that's true. Really. Let's say, yeah. Okay, let's say they did. Let's say that white people admitted it. Let's say it was on TV. Let's say somebody put it in skywriting. Then what? Now, how are you going to help somebody? What's it going to do for you? How's it going to change your life? It's a kind of performance that sort of thing goes for. In the polling and what people's visceral opinions are, it seems to me that we really need to be having conversations about more urgent things, such as the fact that when you talk about the tasing, to go briefly back to that, the unfortunate fact is that in many situations, at many points in time in America, black men have committed almost half of violent crimes, despite obviously constituting a much smaller percent of the population. That's a problem. Now, one problem might be police officers' overreaction, but just as important to me is, what are we going to do about our community so that people don't wind up having to expose themselves to those manifestations of racism? I just think that, for one thing, it's extremely controversial in 2006 that racism is an obstacle to success. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but is it an obstacle? And could you look your grandfather in the eye and really say that the obstacle you face is worth devoting whole radio and television shows about? And second is the fact that, really, in the grand scheme of things, okay, there are going to be these biases, but there are terrible things going on in the country, terrible things going on in the world. And it's at the point where, to me, the whole issue of stealth racism, which is a brilliant new term, I like that, is more a matter of kind of getting people a flutter when the news cycle is getting a little slow than really thinking about what serious injustice is in the real world as we know it.
Before we move on, though, John, I just throw out one recent study that showed that if you have a black man and a white man, young men, who were going out as part of a study to apply for jobs. The black man with no criminal record will have a harder time than finding a job than a white man with a felony record.
That's certainly
Doesn't that really get to the structures of opportunity?
Yes, it's not just. But the fact of the matter is that today, that black man will get a job. We're talking about these certain statistical discrepancies. It's not like it was in 1960 in Philadelphia. It's just a matter of degree. But I do acknowledge that what you're talking about is true. There are many studies that show things like that.
Jeff?
Yeah, I was in a forum once where black psychologists, after weathering this long debate on the so-called reverse racism mentality, said, how many of you white guys here, if you could trade places with me as a black man to take advantage of all the benefits I have in this society, would do that? Raise your hand. Nobody raised their hand, which proves that at least on some level, when forced to think about it, people can admit that there's still racism and that it manifests largely in what is called white privilege. Now, I just for a second, I got to talk about racism versus prejudice. I believe we can be horribly, horribly prejudiced. But the last I recall, schools like Tennessee State, Grambling, Howard, etc., never practiced segregation, which is the legal blocking of a group or groups of people from attending there. That's a systematic kind of manifestation of your personal prejudice, which equals racism. I think that even when you deal with images, even if you deal with images of racism like the Klan, it's not that they were disliked black people. It's that they were judges and ministers and et cetera, and they were able to block black people from opportunity.
Sorry to cut you off. ER, you got the final word briefly.
Well, I was intrigued by this because in terms of seeing that black people felt the hit of racism more than whites was not surprising because of the way we live in this country. But what was really intriguing is this notion of a truth and reconciliation commission where white people would admit guilt and black people would be asked to forgive them. I think that's too simplistic because it doesn't even look at what's really going on, as John was saying. And it also doesn't account for the fact that a lot of blacks are prejudiced and bigoted, as I think Jeff was alluding to also.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Lots more to talk about. E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. He joined us from Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks
for us.
Cause I never dug disco.